showing us the lasting imprint that early stress has on cellular aging and disease processes. Alyssa Eppel worked with researcher Eli Puterman and other colleagues to examine data for 4,598 men and women collected as part of the U.S. Health and Retirement Study. They assessed cumulative adversity for both childhood and adulthood by reviewing responses to health questionnaires. For childhood stressors, criteria included a participant's family receiving help from relatives because of financial difficulty, the family relocating due to financial difficulties, a participant's father losing his job, a parent's substance abuse or alcohol use causing problems in the home, whether the respondent had experienced physical abuse before the age 18, repeated a school year, or gotten in trouble with the law. The questions about adult stressors surveyed death of a spouse, death of a child, qualifying for Medicaid, experiencing a natural disaster, being wounded in combat, having a partner addicted to drugs or alcohol, being victim of a physical attack, or having a spouse or child with a serious illness. Eppel and Puterman then looked at each respondent's telomere length. They found that while lifetime cumulative adversity significantly predicted telomere shortening, that shortening was due mostly to the adversity experienced in childhood. Adult adversity on its own was not significantly associated with telomere shortening. For each childhood adversity a study participant experienced, his or her odds of having shorter telomeres increased by 11%. Eppel and Puterman's data also showed that household adversities, such as abuse or having a parent who used alcohol or drugs, were a stronger predictor of telomere shortening than household financial stress. Further work by researchers Aoife O'Donovan and Thomas Nalin compared the telomeres of people with PTSD with the telomeres of people in good mental health. What they found was that overall, those with PTSD had shorter telomeres than those in the control group. However, what was really interesting was that the people with PTSD who did not have early childhood adversity didn't tend to have shorter telomeres. The good news is that even if you have shortened telomeres, maintaining healthy telomeres can protect you from further shortening. How do you keep your telomeres healthy? One important way is by boosting levels of telomerase, which is an enzyme that can actually lengthen the telomere. Once again, the science is new, but it suggests that even if you start out with shorter than normal telomeres, you can still slow decline by increasing your telomerase with things like meditation and exercise. So does that mean genes don't matter? All you need is a mom who licks and grooms you a lot? Not so fast. While the epigenetic part of the equation is new and exciting and tells us a lot we didn't know, there's no discounting the impact of the DNA that comes from the good old egg and sperm. As we know, it's all about nature and nurture. You're handing down to your kids both your genome and your epigenome, and they both count in determining health. For instance, you might be blessed with some crazy long telomeres. Maybe every woman on your mother's side of the family has lived to be over 100 while never looking a day over 75. But during early childhood, you experienced adversity, and now you have a high ACE score. Your telomeres are being chipped away at faster than normal rates. But because of your genetically long telomeres, you've got a cushion. In that case, there may not be a dramatic result. You're not necessarily going to live to be 100, but you also might not see the premature mortality that your ACE score would predict. However, If you don't have the genetic advantage of long telomeres, it could be a different story. If you go through childhood adversity, the shortening of your telomeres could lead to worse health outcomes than you might otherwise experience. And just like two siblings with the same parents might have different eye colors, they might also have different lengths of telomeres, which can lead to different outcomes, even if they experience similar doses of adversity. The research on epigenetic regulation and telomeres reinforced what I already suspected. Early detection is critical. Now more than ever, I believed if we could identify those at risk for toxic stress by screening for ACEs, we had a better chance of both catching related illnesses early and treating them more effectively. Not only that, but we could also possibly prevent future illness by treating the underlying problem, a damaged stress response system. If we put the right protocols into place in pediatric offices across the city, country, and world, we could intervene in time to walk back epigenetic damage and change long-term health outcomes for the roughly 67% of the population with ACEs and their children, and someday their great-grandchildren. The potential for outcomes like these and the science behind them had me fired up. I had already graduated from talking people's ears off at cocktail parties to reaching out to every well-connected person I knew in the medical community in search of someone who had more power than I did and who would commit to doing something. My own clinic had already begun instituting routine ACE screening for every patient. But there were so many other doctors out there who could benefit from this information. Having grown up in Palo Alto in the 80s, back when it was closer to middle class, as opposed to straight up wealthy, which it is now, I knew that kids with ACEs live in lots of different kinds of neighborhoods. Several of my classmates at Palo Alto High School attempted suicide when I was there, and I later heard stories of parental substance abuse and mental illness the students had struggled with in secret. Even in areas much better off than Bayview, toxic stress was essentially invisible to the healthcare system. Bayview might be a fairly obvious place to look for the impact of adversity, but toxic stress is an unseen epidemic affecting every single community. Since the original ACE study was published, 39 states and the District of Columbia have collected population ACE data. Those reporting their data show that between 55 and 62% of the population have experienced at least one category of ACE, and between 13 and 17% of the population have an ACE score of 4 or more. The states with the highest rates of ACEs among young children were Alabama, Indiana, Kentucky, Michigan, Mississippi, Montana, Oklahoma, and West Virginia. Left unchecked, the effects of ACEs and the toxic stress they create were being handed down by well-meaning parents in families all across the country, and undoubtedly around the world. After a great conversation with Dr. Martin Brotman, the CEO of California Pacific Medical Center at the time, and my stalwart champion, I saw my chance. Every hospital CEO in San Francisco was part of an organization called the Hospital Council of Northern and Central California. This group came together for lots of reasons, but one of its many jobs was addressing healthcare disparities in the city. Dr. Brotman helped lead the Health Disparities Task Force within the council and was excited about what I had told him about ACEs and our work at the clinic. He immediately invited me to give a presentation about ACEs to the council. feeling the kind of excitement that almost makes you want to throw up, I left his office that day thinking, this is it. This was my chance to go to the decision makers and the healthcare shapers and blow the lid off this thing. I'd better not screw it up. I spent weeks preparing for my presentation. On the day, I knew I was ready. But as I sat in the lobby after showing up ridiculously early, I realized I hadn't ever been this nervous, not even for my medical boards. I had just a small block of time on the CEO's agenda, and when I was finally shown into the room, they were all there. Mostly older men, mostly white, there were roughly 12 of them, comfortably spread out around a U-shaped table, papers stacked and strewn around their salad plates, multiple beverages stationed next to laptops. Some smiled pleasantly, while others nodded. For a minute, I cursed my bad luck for having gotten a slot at the end of what was obviously a very long business meeting. If I couldn't keep them riveted, I hoped I could at least keep them awake. Dr. Brotman stood up and graciously introduced me. I shook hands with everyone and then made my way to the front of the room and popped my jump drive into the computer. After what felt like the longest 30 seconds of my life, the drive connected and I pulled up my first PowerPoint slide. I looked up and noticed a short, heavy-set Caucasian woman in the back, silently clearing plates and refilling coffee. It crossed my mind briefly that I wouldn't mind trading places with her. A tremor of self-doubt unsettled me for a moment. I took a deep breath. If this were about me, I wouldn't even be here. No way. But this was for my patients. With that in mind, I silently exhaled and started talking. For a good 25 minutes, I held forth, trotting out the data, the science, the biological mechanisms. Like Dr. Felitti, I was convinced that once people saw the figures, the sheer numbers of people living with the effects of ACEs, they would be blown away. I didn't talk about my patients at all. I talked about their stress response systems. Months of practicing my talking points at borderline socially inappropriate moments had helped me polish what I thought were my most powerful arguments. Finally, I stopped. I paused for a few moments, hoping to let the import of it all sink in. Then I said some approximation of, "Okay, you guys, what are you going to do about it?" I looked at their expressions. I could tell immediately that their reaction was not going to be what I had hoped. My stomach tightened. A slow-moving burn began to make its way across my face, spreading the embarrassment cell by cell. My body may have registered it before my mind, but rapidly I knew one thing. Though it seemed they all agreed that what I had just said was both striking and important, they could clearly tell that I was profoundly naive about how things worked. What was written on their expressions was soon followed up by statements amounting to something along the lines of, "Okay, Nadine, what are you going to do about it?" Looking back on it, I realize that all I did was present them with a problem. When they asked me questions about solutions, I didn't have good answers. They probed me about screening protocols and wanted to know what best treatment practices were and how I thought they could be implemented. I tried my best to explain that right now there wasn't a protocol for anything. That's why I was coming to them. Wouldn't they figure out how to implement the best universal screening tools and come up with protocols for other doctors? That was their job, right? Judging by the thrust of their questions, it sure wasn't. It became pretty clear that the CEOs weren't going to take up this cause on their own time, despite the fact that they were supportive of it. In terms of priority, it certainly wasn't going to jump the line ahead of seismic upgrades for their buildings or the next audit from the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations. How naive was I to think that they would just drop everything for this? I sputtered through my goodbyes, all the while feeling like a cartoon balloon, slowly and sadly deflating in the middle of the room. I don't remember how that meeting ended, what I said, or who sent me on my way with a kind nod and a handshake. There's still a bit of a fog about the last couple minutes of the meeting. Eventually, I reached the elevator and proceeded to jam my finger against the down button. I had worked really hard. I had prepared. I had convinced them. But still, nothing was going to come of any of this. I had been living in the world of ACEs and toxic stress so intensely for so long that it felt like the most important thing in the universe. It was straight up weird to me that I could explain this to other doctors, and they could see it too, and even agree, but still not jump out of their chairs. I wasn't mad or upset at them. I was just confused. My sense of confidence in reality as I knew it was shaken. And this led me to a line of questioning I hadn't entertained before. What if this puzzle I had put together about adversity wasn't the five-alarm fire I thought it was? Even worse, what if there wasn't anything we could do about it? Part 3. Prescription. Chapter 7. The ACE Antidote. Leaving the hospital council meeting that day, I was so distracted by my self-defeating questions that I didn't even notice when she first called out. The elevator yawned open. "Excuse me, doctor," she repeated. I turned and saw that it was the woman who had been pouring coffee for the CEOs in the conference room at the beginning of my presentation. "Yes?" She took a tentative step toward me. Up close, I could see that she had a rough-looking dye job and one tooth missing on the right side, but she was neatly tucked in and buttoned up in her hotel uniform. I paused for a moment and then let the elevator door close behind me, giving her my full attention. "That's me," the woman said. "Pardon?" "That's me that you were talking about up there. Those ACEs, the bad things that happen to people when they're kids, all of that stuff you were talking about has happened to me. I've got every single one of those. I think I'm a 10 out of 10. She paused and took a deep breath, shifting her gaze down to a small, dark gray tattoo on her left wrist. "I've been working to stay sober, and I've had lots of problems with my health. After hearing what you had to say just now, I feel like I finally understand what's been going on with me." Her eyes met mine. "Anyways, I just wanted to say thank you. Keep doing what you're doing." "What's your name?" I asked. "Marjorie," she said, smiling. I smiled back. "Thank you, Marjorie." Since that day with Marjorie and the hospital council, after every talk and every presentation, I make it a point to go up to the people clearing the tables or breaking down the PA system to ask them what they thought. No matter how well my presentations are received professionally, talking to those folks always gives me additional insight into how the story of ACEs is playing out in people's day-to-day lives. I walk away understanding that no matter the geographies, ethnicities, and socioeconomic backgrounds, were all affected by ACEs in similar ways. I was trained to believe in the power of clinical medicine and public health to improve lives. Yet it's clear from these conversations that many people who have experienced ACEs and are grappling with their lifelong effects don't know what they're dealing with. No doctor has ever told them that there might be a problem with their stress response system, much less suggested what to do about it. Those few minutes in front of the elevator with Marjorie served as both a touchstone and a swift kick in the butt. If we didn't have the clinical protocol to address ACEs and its many health impacts, then it was time to create one. Fortunately, I was too naive to understand how huge a task that would ultimately be. On a small scale, we were already making progress at the clinic, so I knew we were on the right track. Along with screening all children for ACEs at their annual checkups, we were actively putting the toxic stress lens on our treatment plans and starting to look for evidence-based models that focused on the underlying biology of children, parents, and communities dealing with the impacts of adversity. Outside of ours, there were no pediatric clinics I knew of that routinely screened for ACEs in 2008. Patients with toxic stress were most likely to come to the attention of their pediatrician with symptoms of behavioral problems or ADHD, which, as it turns out, was good news for them because it meant that they were likely to be referred to a professional in the mental health field, one of the few healthcare specialties that had recognized the link between early adversity and poor health. Unfortunately, many physicians had no clear understanding that clinical illnesses like asthma and diabetes might also be manifestations of toxic stress. As we saw with Diego, psychotherapy was in fact one of the most well-supported therapeutic interventions for patients with symptoms of toxic stress, whether those symptoms were behavioral or not. When primary care doctors have easy access to mental health services for their patients, those patients have a better shot at getting the treatment they need. To that end, one of the best approaches for helping doctors who care for patients with ACEs and toxic stress, which statistically speaking is every single doctor in America, is integrated behavioral health services. That simply means having mental health services available at the pediatrician's or primary care clinician's office. Later, I would find out that this was an emerging best practice, one now being endorsed by just about every national healthcare oversight agency, including the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The Bayview community had asked for mental health services before I'd read the ACE study. That's why I brought Dr. Clark on board. Having a mental health clinician in our office was so successful, and Dr. Clark was in such high demand, that I was soon looking for more mental health resources to pour into our clinic. For most pediatricians working in low-income, underserved areas like I was, the available resources would typically be limited to a referral to a community agency, possibly a social worker if you were lucky, and then you'd cross your fingers and maybe say a few prayers. But in the months leading up to when I started treating Nia, we had begun working with Dr. Alicia Lieberman at the University of California, San Francisco, a renowned child psychologist who specialized in child-parent psychotherapy, CPP. This type of therapy focuses on children from birth to 5 years old and is built on the notion that to help young kids experiencing adversity, you have to treat the parent and child like a team. The groundbreaking aspect of CPP, and what Dr. Lieberman believes makes it so effective, is the recognition that real conversation with kids about how trauma is affecting them and their families, even when kids are really little, is critical. Alicia Lieberman recalls, as one of her earliest memories, the experience of waking up in the middle of the night to an odd feeling of movement. Growing up in Paraguay, during a time of political revolution and unrest, she saw her father, a pediatrician who spoke out about the social injustices he witnessed, become a target of the government. He was periodically jailed for interrogation, but as a respected member of the community, he was returned each time. The growing civil unrest left the family constantly on edge. More and more community leaders were being jailed or simply disappeared. When Alicia woke that night, she saw her mother and father were carrying the bed with her still in it. Her parents were transporting their sleeping daughter to the innermost room of the house to protect her from stray bullets that might come through the walls. Eventually, she and her family emigrated, taking a transatlantic ocean liner to Israel. On the ship, a fellow traveler asked the young girl what it was like to live under that kind of stress. At the mention of the events they were leaving behind, Dr. Lieberman remembers tensing up and having the realization that stress lives in the body. Dr. Lieberman started her professional work from a place of deep, personal familiarity and curiosity around trauma and stress. On top of the instability and fear of the family's political circumstances, when Alicia was 4 years old, the tragic death of a sibling threw her parents into a state of profound grief. The surviving children were never told what happened, and young Alicia was left to create her own narrative, a story conjured up by her imagination out of confusion and sadness. As she got further into the study of child psychology, she saw that talking about the past openly and honestly with children wasn't common practice. The thinking at the time was that little children don't understand things like death and violence, and if you tried to talk to them about it, you would just re-traumatize them. Dr. Lieberman doubted that the practice of telling Santa Claus stories to little children when bad things happened was doing them any good. Dr. Lieberman debunked the long-held myth that young children and babies don't need treatment for trauma because they somehow don't understand or remember the chaotic experiences they faced. Her work is built on the research that shows that early adversity often has an outsized effect on infants and young children, just like it did on Dr. Hayes's tadpoles. After years as a clinician, Dr. Lieberman came to understand that children's need to create a story or a narrative out of confusing events is actually very normal. Children are compelled to give meaning to what's happening to them. When there's no clear explanation, they make one up. The intersection of trauma and the developmentally appropriate egocentrism of childhood often leads a little kid to think, "I made it happen." Dr. Lieberman sought to explore ways in which both parents and children could talk openly and honestly about trauma. She also rightly recognized that parents' own rough childhoods and the scars that they still carried might affect the way they responded to their children in stressful or traumatic circumstances, hindering their ability to act as a protective buffer. She learned from her mentor, Selma Freiberg, that families can learn how to speak the unspeakable, and that parents can discover tools to support and buffer their children, even in moments of crisis. Eventually, Dr. Lieberman would go on to codify the CPP protocol and demonstrate its efficacy in 5 separate randomized controlled trials. Supported by the latest science, CPP is now one of the country's leading trauma treatments for young children, and it is instrumental in helping the whole family begin to heal. CPP takes into consideration all the other pressures and drama that both parent and child have to deal with. Other family members, the community, work, or lack thereof. Everything that affects the parent-child bond. This allows patients to make connections between the traumas of the past and the stressors of the present, so they can better recognize their triggers and manage their symptoms. Traditionally, if a mom is depressed, she finds her own therapist and they work one-on-one. CPP's approach is based on the understanding that the quality of the relationship and the health of the attachment between the parent and child are absolutely fundamental to health and well-being. There was hardly a clearer case of this than Charlene and Nia. Fortunately, Dr. Todd Rentschler, a postdoctoral fellow under Dr. Lieberman's supervision, was just joining our team when Charlene and Nia first came into my waiting room. Charlene was understandably furious with me for months after I filed the report with Child Protective Services. But in their case, it was exactly what needed to happen. In order to keep custody of Nia, Charlene was required to get help with her postpartum depression, which meant intensive psychotherapy. When Charlene came to her first CPP session with Dr. Rentschler, she had her iPod earbuds dug in deep, with the volume turned up so high he could have tapped along to the beat. She plopped Nia down on the couch beside her and stared blankly at Dr. Rentschler. Needless to say, the first sessions were pretty challenging. Charlene felt betrayed by me and felt she was being forced to do something against her will. An experienced and patient clinician, Dr. Rentschler took his time building rapport with Charlene, starting off by giving her some choice in how the sessions would proceed, offering her some power in a situation where she felt totally powerless. Instead of diving right into Nia's health and Charlene's depression, he started by addressing what Charlene said was her biggest problem, something that every parent of an infant can relate to: serious lack of sleep. Nia was waking up frequently in the night, and Charlene was exhausted and frustrated. It was no surprise that Charlene and Nia were struggling with sleep. Researchers have found that infants of depressed moms have a harder time regulating their sleep. They sleep an average of 97 fewer minutes at night than infants of non-depressed moms and have more nighttime wakenings. Childhood adversity significantly increases the risk for just about every sleep disorder there is, including nightmares, insomnia, narcolepsy, sleepwalking, and psychiatric sleep disorders. Sleep eating, anyone? Nighttime sleep plays a powerful role in influencing brain function, hormones, the immune system, and even the transcription of DNA. Sleep helps properly regulate both the HPA and SAM axes. During sleep, levels of cortisol, adrenaline, and noradrenaline drop. As a result, lack of sleep is associated with increased levels of stress hormones and increased stress reactivity. As you know from chapters 5 and 6, these stress hormones kick off the party, triggering brain, hormone, immune, and epigenetic responses to stress. The downstream effects are impaired cognitive function, memory, and mood regulation. Sleep deprivation doesn't just make you groggy and cranky. It also makes you sick. Lack of sleep is associated with increased inflammation, and reduced effectiveness of the immune system. While you're catching your Z's, your immune system does a systems upgrade, using the downtime to calibrate its defenses. Everyone knows that it's important to get sleep when you're sick, but it's just as important when you're healthy. Lack of sleep leaves people more susceptible to illness because the immune system doesn't appropriately fight off the viruses and bacteria that it's constantly exposed to. Poor sleep is also associated with reduction in hormones, such as growth hormone, and changes to DNA transcription, which for children can be especially problematic, opening the door to issues with growth and development. Dr. Rentschler worked with Charlene to create a routine that would help Nia sleep for longer stretches. He started by helping Charlene understand the importance of putting Nia to bed in a cool, dark, and quiet environment at the same time every night, avoiding stressful or stimulating activities just before sleep, and instead giving her a soothing bath and reading a story before bedtime. Eventually, both mom and baby started getting some much-needed shut-eye. Feeling understood and ultimately supported in this problem helped Charlene believe Dr. Rentschler knew what he was doing. More important, she saw that he was there to help her. Soon, Charlene began to open up about the lack of support she had. Her ex-boyfriend, Nia's dad, had been abusive during her pregnancy and was now out of the picture. She lived with her maternal aunt, who had raised Charlene and her little brother, since their mother committed suicide when Charlene was a young child. Ever since she had told her aunt she was pregnant, she received more criticism than support. Despite living with her aunt, she felt completely isolated, and it only got worse when Nia was born so prematurely. The further Dr. Rentschler and Charlene got in their conversations about her relationship with her aunt, the more she expressed wanting to have a different kind of relationship with Nia. In a nuts and bolts way, meeting this goal came down to examining how she was interacting with Nia. In the CPP sessions, when Nia cried or smiled, Dr. Rentschler encouraged Charlene to think about how that felt and what she thought it meant. Once when Nia was in her lap, the baby reached up and pulled out Charlene's earbuds. At first, she was annoyed with her daughter's bad behavior. But when Dr. Rentschler wondered aloud what else Nia could be communicating with that action, Charlene admitted that maybe her baby just wanted her attention. Charlene's aunt was critical, distant, and unwilling to give her the kind of support she was craving. So when similar dynamics seemed to be playing out with Nia, Dr. Rentschler helped Charlene recognize that and think about how she might respond differently. Soon, the relationship started to shift. Charlene began taking one earbud out during sessions, and then finally both. As she became more tuned in to her daughter, Nia responded with fewer cries and more of the coos and laughs that, as any parent knows, are the sweet rewards that make up for the midnight feedings and cranky mornings. Charlene also began to take a more active role in solving her baby's failure to gain weight. In her sessions with Dr. Rentschler, she wanted him to help her fix the bottle at just the right temperature and asked a lot of questions about baby food and feeding. Our clinic team worked together to support Charlene with practical advice, nutrition information, and access to resources. We also regularly communicated as a team about Nia's progress. Through these supportive conversations, Charlene's resentment about the CPS report began to fade, and she became less angry with me. While Charlene was doing great in therapy sessions and her relationship with Nia, she continued to have issues with her aunt. One day, she made baby food for Nia, a big step for her, and forgot to put away a bowl after she was done. Her aunt was so pissed off that she told Charlene she could no longer use the kitchen. Charlene felt frustrated and defeated. There she was, trying to do the right thing, and her aunt was punishing her for a small oversight. But the incident opened up space for Charlene to talk more with Dr. Rentschler about her relationship to her aunt, the loss of her mother, and even her feelings of helplessness and depression following Nia's birth. Her aunt had been angry when Charlene got pregnant, and without her aunt as a support system, Charlene had felt completely alone. Then the baby had stopped growing suddenly and had to be delivered via emergency C-section, and no one could tell Charlene why. After all, she wasn't smoking or taking drugs, and as far as she knew, she had been doing everything right. At the time, we didn't have answers for her. It wasn't until later that I learned just how closely ACEs and high doses of maternal stress were related to premature birth, low birth weight, and increased rates of miscarriage. When Nia was in the NICU, Charlene was completely physically disconnected from her child. Nia didn't look like any baby Charlene had ever seen before. She was small and frail, with multiple tubes and monitors connected to her tiny body. Charlene was terrified that her daughter would die, and she began to wall herself off emotionally. People leaving was something Charlene was accustomed to. She had never known her father, and her mother had left her and her brother when Charlene was just 5 years old. In a way, Charlene was preparing herself for the inevitable, the loss of her daughter. Through her conversations with Dr. Rentschler, Charlene realized that it was actually possible to talk through some of these difficult experiences. She wished that she could do this with her aunt, but her aunt, who had lost a child as a young mother, had her own wall up, making the intergenerational cycle of distance, disconnection, and stress seem impenetrable. As Dr. Rentschler and Charlene worked together over time, Charlene began seeking a replacement for that maternal connection. Though her ex, Tony, was out of the picture, his older sister was welcoming of Charlene and wanted to have a relationship with Nia. Charlene started taking her daughter over to see her paternal aunt and began spending more and more time there. Dr. Rentschler explained to Charlene that forming caring relationships like the one she now had with Tony's sister was an important ingredient for health, both her child's and her own. Then, seemingly out of nowhere, Charlene stopped coming to therapy. Dr. Rentschler didn't see her for 2 weeks, and though he phoned and left several voicemails, his calls were never returned. When she finally came back, Charlene had the faint outline of a black eye, and her earbuds were firmly in place. A crying Nia sat beside her on the couch, and Charlene was once again staring blankly at the wall. All those months of progress seemed to have evaporated. Only gradually did Dr. Rentschler get the full story from Charlene. She had been visiting Tony's sister with Nia when Tony showed up out of the blue, agitated and ranting. While she was holding Nia, he suddenly attacked her. Terrified, she ran away to call the police, leaving Nia with Tony's sister. Following the attack, it was as if Charlene and her daughter had been transported back in time. Nia was up all night, screaming and inconsolable, and they were whisked back to the land of no sleep. Over the next several sessions, it became clear that what had happened with Tony had sent Charlene back into a depression and Nia into a state of distress. During one session, when Nia was crying inconsolably, Charlene said to Dr. Rentschler, "She just gets so mad at me." They talked more about how Charlene felt when Nia screamed and cried, and Charlene admitted to worrying that Nia was going to be short-tempered like Tony. She got mad at Nia for crying because she didn't want people to think that her 10-month-old baby was crazy like her dad. Charlene kept going to CPP, and she and Dr. Rentschler worked hard to find a path back to the success they'd had early on. During a particularly hard session, Charlene quietly put her hand on her stomach. When Dr. Rentschler asked what she was experiencing, she explained this was what she did when she was really upset, something that helped her calm down when she felt she was going to lose it. Dr. Rentschler told her it was actually a really good sign that she could recognize when she felt that way. Often, when people's stress response becomes activated, their biological systems are so overstimulated that they don't know what to make of it. This lack of understanding means that people don't take time to collect themselves. They just react in whatever ways their bodies tell them to, lashing out at others, acting impulsively, or self-medicating. For Charlene, this made intuitive sense. The conversation about biology opened the door for Dr. Rentschler to discuss mindfulness, the practice of being aware of internal thoughts and feelings in a sustained way. There were several calming techniques that Charlene could use when she was feeling stressed or overwhelmed, and she and Dr. Rentschler worked on using breathing and awareness to focus and soothe her body's response to stress. Charlene started employing mindfulness strategies at home when she and her aunt fought and found it to be a big help. While the trauma with Tony definitely set Charlene back, eventually, after filing charges against him for assault and working through the shame and anger she felt about it, things got better. Dr. Rentschler, with the support of the clinic staff, continued to work with Charlene and Nia on feeding, sleep, and mindfulness, reinforcing techniques that could be used again and again when things happened to trigger them both, bringing trauma to the surface. The good news was that the healthier Charlene got, the healthier Nia got. Over time, she put on weight and caught up on her developmental milestones, and the CPS case was successfully resolved. Charlene started looking for work and even described to Dr. Rentschler how she used her mindfulness exercises to help calm herself during a stressful job interview. She got the job, moved into her own apartment, and eventually got into a healthy relationship. By then, Charlene had forgiven me for the CPS report. I had made a point of checking in on mother and baby when they arrived to see Dr. Rentschler. Eventually, we resumed our relationship for Nia's regular checkups. When Charlene came in and told me about getting the job, it felt like a victory. Instead of just treating the symptoms of Nia's failure to thrive, we had been able to treat the root of it, the stress caused by depression and trauma and an unhealthy family dynamic. Despite setbacks along the way, the child-parent psychotherapy had been a real success, changing the dynamic that was affecting Nia's health and strengthening Charlene's ability to act as a buffer for her child when problems arose. To this day, I will never forget the image of a chunky 16-month-old Nia toddling through the clinic, giggling and being chased by her mother. As a doctor, there are moments when you realize that you have saved a life. It's a tremendous feeling of satisfaction mixed with exhaustion, that most often occurs in the chaos of the hospital after a successful resuscitation. As I saw Nia coming up the hall, I was struck with that same feeling. We did good. As my colleagues and I made a conscious effort to look at our patients through the ACE lens, the small victories started coming more and more steadily. While there were certainly challenges and stumbling blocks, we were having great success finding ways to help our patients with ACEs soothe their disrupted stress response systems and manage their symptoms more effectively. We found that a focus on the underlying biology of toxic stress and the factors that help balance the dysregulated pathways, sleep, integrated mental health services, and healthy relationships, made a big difference for our patients. Soon, we were on the lookout for more tools to use in our toxic stress toolkit. Pediatric obesity is one of the major health problems we targeted. With heartbreaking consistency, the 94124 zip code had the highest rate of obesity in all of San Francisco. Bayview is a food desert, which means there are way more fast food outlets here than in other neighborhoods, and almost nowhere to get fresh fruits and vegetables. I experienced this firsthand when I didn't have time to go food shopping and couldn't bring my lunch to work for a week. My options included all the greasy shades of fast food: taco truck, Taco Bell, McDonald's, KFC, and the least of the evils, Subway. Despite what its marketing department says, there are only so many days in a row a girl can eat a Subway sandwich. Thanks to a grant from a local foundation, we were able to implement a cool obesity treatment program modeled on the successful program at Stanford. Every Tuesday evening, two nutritionists from CPMC and two trainers from the Bayview YMCA came to the clinic to lead a group of our overweight patients and their parents. The kids went with the trainers to do some fun physical activity in a former warehouse space at the back of the clinic. It was a pretty bare-bones setup, but the area was large enough for a group of 20 kids to play volleyball, dance Zumba, hula hoop, and do whatever else would get them to work up a sweat. At the same time, their parents received hands-on instruction on how to prepare nutritious meals, and everyone ended the evening with a delicious, healthy dinner. To top it off, we had received some donated bicycles from a local company, so each kid who met his or her treatment goal would get a bike. You would think that this shiny kid bait would be enough to keep my patients on track, but the truth was that most of our kids really struggled. Bayview parents couldn't just let their kids run wild at the local park the way my parents did with my brothers and me. Parents in Bayview made sure their kids stayed safe by keeping them indoors, which meant that any stressful family dynamics were intensified. My colleagues and I knew that, as always, our kids with ACEs needed some extra help. To do that, we made sure that every patient in the program with a high ACE score, which was most of them, also received mental health treatment with Dr. Clark. Their therapy sessions focused on how individual life experiences might be affecting their weight. The results were so good, it almost made me want to Zumba in celebration. Almost. Pediatric obesity is a notoriously tough nut to crack, especially in communities like Bayview. But at the end of this program, every last bike was gone. The program's success showed us that addressing ACEs as part of a weight reduction program was essential. But in an interesting twist, we found that if our goal had been simply to address ACEs instead of obesity, exercise and nutrition would still have been an important part of that. It wasn't our initial intention to treat our patients' toxic stress with dodgeball and cooking classes, but we were pleasantly surprised to see how much kids improved when we added healthy diet and exercise incentives to therapy. I sat down to check in with the moms and grandmas each week, and they reported that when they changed their children's diet and their levels of exercise went up, the kids slept better and felt healthier. And in many cases, their behavioral issues and sometimes their grades improved. We found that there was plenty of science to support what we were seeing clinically. The data showed that regular exercise helped increase the release of a protein called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which basically acts like Miracle-Gro for brain and nerve cells. BDNF is active in the parts of the brain important for learning and memory, like the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex. We've long known that exercise improves cardiovascular health, but the research is piling up in exciting new directions, showing us that moving our bodies builds our brains as well as our muscles. When it comes to combating toxic stress, addressing the dysregulated immune system is as important as supporting brain function. Regular exercise has also been shown to help regulate the stress response and reduce the presence of inflammatory cytokines. You might remember that cytokines are the chemical alarms that fire up your immune system and tell it to fight. For a person with toxic stress, moderate physical activity, like breaking a sweat for roughly an hour a day, can help the body better decide which fights to pick and which ones to walk away from. While moderate exercise helps better regulate the stress response, there's no need to sign up for that ultra marathon. If you get too crazy, intense wear and tear on your body can actually increase cortisol levels. We saw that exercising made a huge difference for our kids, but so did eating right. Making a few specific changes to what grade of fuel went in the tank, for example, substituting lean proteins and complex carbohydrates for greasy fast food, improved the body's ability to regulate itself. We explained that exercising and eating healthfully not only contributed to weight loss, but also helped boost the immune system and improve brain function. We talked about how inflammation is one of the ways a well-regulated immune system fights off infection. But as with everything else in the body, balance is critical. Too much inflammation causes all sorts of problems, from digestive issues to cardiovascular complications. Eating foods that are high in omega-3 fatty acids, antioxidants, and the fibers from fruits, vegetables, and whole grains helps fight inflammation and bring the immune system back into balance. By contrast, a diet high in refined sugar, starches, and saturated fats can promote further inflammation and imbalance. By choosing a healthier pattern of eating and adding moderate exercise to their routines, our patients had two great ways to bring their biological systems into better balance. At that point, my staff and I had some strong strategies for specifically targeting and healing the dysregulated stress response. Sleep, mental health, healthy relationships, exercise, and nutrition. Not surprisingly, these are the same things that, as Elizabeth Blackburn and Alyssa Epple's research showed, boost levels of telomerase, the enzyme that helps to rebuild shortened telomeres. Of course, I was excited to find more. So once again, I pored through the literature looking for treatments that could lower cortisol levels, regulate the HPA axis, balance the immune system, and improve cognitive functioning. Over and over again, research pointed to one treatment in particular, meditation. Though many of us have been led to believe that meditation requires brightly colored robes and a mountaintop, or at least lots of crystals and green juice, training the mind has fortunately become a lot more mainstream than that. While techniques based on meditation practices began with religious sects thousands of years ago, they're now being used by an unlikely successor, the medical community. From cardiologists to oncologists, doctors have begun incorporating mind training into their clinical treatments. Dr. John Zamara and his colleagues